Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine Street in Urbana. This Saturday, April 3rd, from 2 to 6 p.m., the Corkscrew is hosting a tasting of Cabernet Sauvignons from around the world, from Bordeaux to the Napa Valley. More information is available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of chocolate, 40 kinds of coffee, and 200 kinds of tea. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
It's 6 minutes after 1 o'clock Central Time, and this is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, the Information Advantage. Celeste Quinn is away. I'm Tom Rogers, and it's March 29th. 2004, it's 18 days before April 15th. And today on the Afternoon Magazine, we bring our two tax experts in to answer your questions about filing those returns as the hours click by and people get into panic mode. Maybe, maybe not. Marty Verdick and Steve Winterstein are from the tax department of RSM McGladrey, and they'll be able to take your calls this afternoon. If you've got questions about filing your tax return, our guests are ready to take them. They were here back in February for some of the early birds, and they're back to get those questions that you may have had last time but weren't able to call in, and or for many of us who just started on the tax returns or thinking about maybe starting them sometime between now and the 15th. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, call us up. The number is 333-9455. 333-WILL. If you're outside the local dialing area, our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We've been doing the program for a couple times a year for many years now, and Marty is a veteran of the show, I guess we can say, 5 or 6 years, you said?
I believe that's right, yeah. It's always good to come back.
And Steve, you were here in February, but...
My second time. I feel like a veteran already.
You'll get your stripes after this one now.
There you go.
Marty Verdict is a managing director for RSM McGladrey's tax department, and Steve Winterstein is a manager there. Once again, 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and I was set to ask you all sorts of questions about which deductions people forget and how you should prepare to get your tax returns done and all that, but we've already got two calls, so let's get straight
to
them.
Let's go.
Champaign on line one, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a question about non-cash contributions to various charitable organizations. We're at the point where we have a lot of things to get rid of, clothes we no longer use, toys, books, and we inventory them using Kiplinger's Deduction Pro. But there's that little matter of documentation and a $500 limit. How much documentation do we actually have to have? Is that limit effectively an annual limit for everything?
Well, the $500 limit, there are actually two separate limits that apply to non-cash contributions. In the case of non-cash contributions that are under $500 in total, there is no additional form to be filed. You simply include the value of those contributions on your Schedule A in the charitable contribution section, and that's it. You are required to maintain records so that if you were to be audited, you would have evidence of the donation. So when you go down to Goodwill or Salvation Army and they hand you that receipt, which will be notably blank, by the way, as far as any dollar amount, because the burden of placing the value rests with you. But hang on to those receipts and hang on to the lists of what it is that you gave to those organizations. Now, many times people exceed that $500 amount. That is not a problem. For contributions in excess of $500 but less than $5,000, you need to complete a Form 8283, and on there you will be asked to provide some very basic information such as the name of the organization that you gave it to, their address, a description of what it was that you donated such as clothing or household goods, the date purchased, which I usually put in various because who knows what that was, the date donated, your estimate of its original cost, and your estimate of its fair market value. That's all that needs to be done in the case of donations over $500 but less than $5,000. If by some chance you have a donation of non-cash items other than publicly traded securities, things like that, but let's say that you donate a car to a charity and its value is $6,000. We hear lots of advertising for donate your car to the American Cancer Society, for example. I hear that up in Chicago a lot. If it exceeds $5,000, you're required to get an appraisal of that, and the appraisor and the recipient organization are both required to sign the second page of the Form 8283. So it gets a little more complicated if you have over $5,000, and it is an annual limit.
And the $500, if you give to many organizations and the total of all of those non-cash gifts exceed $500, it doesn't matter that none of them, no individual organization was less than $500. Once the total reaches $500, you must disclose the name, address, and other information that Marty talked about for each non-cash contribution.
What if one doesn't really have any idea of some of the informational items, like how much a particular old book cost originally?
Oh, at that point, it depends how creative you can be, but generally, I usually estimate that something's value is no more than 15 to 20% of its original cost. For example, if you're looking at clothing, so if someone said, well, I have $400 of value in today's dollars of clothing that I donated, I'm guessing that had to have an original cost of $2,000 to $2,500. The IRS doesn't really expect you to have receipts proving what you paid for it, but they're looking for reasonableness.
Precisely. And once the cost exceeds the fair market value, then it won't affect your computation at all. Their only concern is if the cost is actually a great deal less than value.
Would that be a safe assumption if you're using something like Kiplinger's deduction pro for estimating the current value?
Well, given that it would have no impact on the tax deduction, I would say that should be a fairly safe estimate.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you for your call. Let's go to line two in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having the program. Let's see. I have what I think is a hard problem, a hard question, and if it's not, that'll be wonderful. But if it is, and you need time to think about it, I can just hang up and listen. But I had a fairly minimal income in 2003. It was only a little over $5,000. And so one of the tax tables I've seen in those little booklets says that in most cases you don't even have to file.
That would generally be true, depending upon the nature of the income. Are you claimed as a dependent on another's tax return?
Okay. The nature of my income is that none of it is from wages, and almost all of it is from is on a 1099-B.
Okay.
Commodity futures trading.
Okay.
And so I've seen in another one of the booklets, I've seen something about 1099-DIV, but this is not quite the same thing.
Well, commodity futures trading are governed by Section 1256, the regulated futures contracts, and the gain, you said you did have a gain from that trading activity?
Yeah.
Okay, the gain is presumed to be 40% short-term and 60% long-term capital gain, as I recall. Generally, I usually suggest that people do file a return in that case to go ahead and report that gain. You will not have any tax liability, generally, at least for federal purposes, but you might very well have an Illinois tax liability, assuming you're an Illinois resident, because the exemption amount for Illinois is fairly small. It's a couple thousand dollars, so you would have an Illinois tax liability, although it would be a very small one.
Okay, that's wonderful. So do you have any idea which forms I should use?
Sure. You would use a 6781, as I recall.
That sounds right, yes.
I think that's the form number for the commodity transaction. When you go through that form, it will lead you through the process of splitting that gain into short-term and long-term. It'll transfer from there to a Schedule D, and from there over to page one of your 1040.
Okay, so I use the full 1040?
Yes, you will need to file a 1040 long form because of these. You would not qualify for the EZ or the A. You'll need to use a long form.
Okay, so that's I guess that was my biggest question. I didn't know if that would apply given the amounts or the how little items there were.
Yep, you will need to file.
Okay, it's the 6781 and the 1040 long form
and a Schedule D.
And Schedule D.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Oh, okay. That's wonderful.
All right, get to work.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call. Marty Verdick and Steve Winterstein from the Tax Department of RSM McGladrey are here to answer your questions about taxes on the Afternoon Magazine. The numbers again, 333-9455, or outside the local calling area, 800-222-9455. 9455. We have a caller on line 4 from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Good afternoon.
This will be an interesting question.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be. I hope it's going to be. First of all, thank you for taking my call. I apologize for my voice. I just lost my voice over the weekend.
Oh, no.
Basically, I have actually have three questions, kind of related questions. First of all, I have a home in Canada, and actually reside in British Columbia. I would like to know whether I could deduct the mortgage interest and also the property tax from using the itemized deduction.
Okay. I'm really going from memory on this one, but as I recall, you are permitted to deduct property taxes on non-U.S. property. Steve, do you remember the answer to that?
I think the answer is yes, but you're also asking about mortgage interest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mortgage interest and the property tax.
Yeah. I thought it had to be a U.S. residence.
Yeah, I think, and we're both going from memory here, and this isn't a question that comes up often, but I believe that the mortgage interest would not be, but the taxes are. But that is, don't take that one to the bank. That's a question that someone would need to actually look up, because it's just that just doesn't come up that often.
Yeah, because according to the tax advisor that I spoke to, because I have a home in Texas and also I have a home in Canada, and the home in Canada, there actually is my wife and my daughters, both of them are staying there. And according to the tax advisor that I spoke to, according to them, they said I could take the deduction, but I'm not really sure about his advice. That's the reason why I called it this one, to get some second opinion on it.
Well, I certainly don't count this as an opinion, because Steve and I are looking at each other both with puzzled looks on our faces, because it's a unique enough question that we'd want to look that up before we could answer with any certainty.
Okay, that sounds great then. I appreciate that answer then.
Well, thanks for your call. And did you say you had other questions?
Yeah, it's one more probably is related to 401k. I'm just wondering whether my wife contributed. No, I'm sorry, it's an IRA. My wife contributed $3,000 to IRA last year, mm-hmm. and she's actually currently living in Canada. Can we take that? Can we put that in and take it as a deduction too?
Is she a Canadian resident or citizen or a U.S.
Yeah,
citizen?
She's a Canadian citizen.
All right. But do you file a joint U.S. federal tax return?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Then I believe the answer, assuming that you meet the other eligibility requirements, because you file a joint U.S. return, if she is eligible for a deductible IRA contribution under U.S. law, I believe that she would be eligible for that on your U.S. return, even though she's a Canadian citizen. Steve, is that consistent with your understanding?
Yes, and I don't think she'd have to have U.S. earnings if he does,
right.
Because he can piggyback on his earnings.
Right.
And
okay.
So I think that's the right answer, yes.
Yep.
Okay, well, that sounds great.
Well, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We don't get too many calls from Canada.
Yeah.
That adds just a whole new level to the complexity, I'm sure, for people who have to file in two different countries.
It does. And,
in fact, have property in two different countries.
Exactly. And the problem is that there are different tax treaties between the U.S. and most other countries. And so it is difficult to answer international questions, because the tax treaty can vary so much from country to country.
All right. Let's go to line one again. Caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yes, I inherited about $3,000 worth of JCPenney common stock from an aunt last year. Now, I know I have to declare the dividends, but when do I declare the value of the stock?
When it's sold
or on a basis value?
When you sell the stock, you'll compare the sales price at that time to the value of the stock at the date you inherited.
Uh-huh.
Not what she paid for it,
yes.
But at the value at the time of her passing.
Okay, so the only thing I declare is the dividends at this point.
That's right. That's right. As far as the laws are concerned, this is your stock, and your basis in it is you paid essentially what the value was at the time of her passing.
Okay.
So you just wait till you sell.
Okay, so no declaration on the value of the stock at the time.
None at all.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And thanks for your call. Our numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Marty and Steve here to answer your tax questions today on the Afternoon Magazine. With 18 days left to go, there are certainly a lot of people who haven't started yet. What are the things that you have to do now, in order to be to not go through the panic and to be as accurate as you can between now and then.
Well, one of the things that I always like to talk about right now for people is for someone who hasn't even started the return yet, they might very well be in a situation where they need to consider an extension of time to file. And one of the things that we always like to point out to people is that an extension is an automatic 4-month extension of time. It basically gets you from April 15th due date to August 15th. But it's important to understand that it is only an extension of time to file the return, not pay the tax.
Is there a cost associated with the extension?
No. And you don't even need a reason. It is an automatic extension. You simply fill out a form 4868, sign it, send it in, include a check if you think you're going to owe money, and away you go. If you don't pay the tax that is ultimately due, if you don't pay that with the extension, the taxpayer will be assessed a late payment penalty.
So this is an extension just to file, not to pay.
That's right. And the late payment penalty is 0.5% per month for each month or portion of a month that the payment is late. Alternatively, for someone who doesn't get around to filing and doesn't file an extension, then you're assessed a late filing penalty, and the penalty is 5% per month or any portion of a month. So the moral of the story is get an extension filed. Even if you can't pay, get the extension filed.
Get the extension filed. Otherwise, it's 5% a month for 5 straight months, 25%
right.
of the total that ends up due. You have to try and estimate as close as you can what you think you're going to owe and pay it on April 15th with the extension, and then you're set to go. To get it filed by August 15th.
Right. What constitutes as close as you can when you're talking about an estimate?
Well, go ahead, Steve.
90%, I believe, is the answer. You have to be 90% or more in order to avoid the penalty. If you've done that, then you will have avoided the penalty. If you've filed the extension and you're short, then you just pay on the amount that you're short. Again, in just 0.5% a month.
But you still have to be within 90%. So it's got to be a pretty good calculation for us.
If you paid in 70%, then the 30% you're short, that would be the only part that would attract penalty, and only 0.5% a month.
Is there any additional scrutiny given to people who file extensions?
That would be the subject of a lot of discussion. I've never seen anything that would convince me one way or the other. One group of people believes that the least amount of time that you give the IRS to look at your return, the better. So they take the ultimate extension and don't file the returns until October 15th. There's another 60 days available after the August 15th deadline. Another group of people believe that if you file an extension, it somehow puts your return in another stack, if you will, and it is more likely to be audited. I've not seen any validity or any numbers that would support either of those schools of thought.
In 25 years, I have to agree completely. It does not add or subtract from the scrutiny.
What does then add to the scrutiny? What kinds of things do you see as raising the red flag for an audit?
Certain medical expenses. Casualty losses are a very big one. Casualty and theft losses gain a lot of scrutiny. Mm-hmm. Medical, if they're unusual items and unusually large.
So, and those are things that can be backed up with receipts.
Of course, there's legitimate reasons for them, but they tend to be areas of misunderstanding and, in some cases, abuse. Mm-hmm.
For example, medical expenses, one of the reasons the IRS would be curious about that is that most people have medical insurance, and medical expenses are only deductible to the extent that they exceed 7.5% of your income. So for the overwhelming majority of taxpayers, they get no benefit from it. So when the IRS sees someone claiming a large medical expense, they might very well wonder, well, what's in there? Is it something that the insurance company didn't reimburse, in which case maybe it's not a deductible item? For example, cosmetic surgery is not a deductible medical expense. Several other things that can raise your chances of being audited. Anytime you have deductions, itemized deductions, which exceed the statistical norms. For example, if you have charitable contributions, which are 2 or 3 times the normal range for someone with your level of income, it might cause the IRS to question it. Another thing would be a self-employed person. Studies have shown that self-employed people, while they account for a relatively small percentage of the taxpayer, they account for a relatively high percentage of unreported income. And as a result, the IRS tends to look at them more.
Yeah. How do they calculate that statistical norm? Do they just plug your numbers into a formula and anything that goes above that is?
Yeah, there is a closely guarded computer model that the IRS uses to compute those. And every tax return that gets filed with the IRS does get the numbers get entered into the IRS computer system, which is one of the reasons they're promoting electronic filing, is it saves them rekeying all this information. Mm-hmm. And so automatically a return is scored against these statistical norms. And if you fall outside the range, you might very well at least receive a notice asking for verification of certain items, and you could be selected for audit.
Once again, we're talking with tax experts Marty Verdick and Steve Winterstein from RSM McGladrey and Champaign, and this is your program. This is your chance to have some experts answer your tax questions that you may have with the time running out before the April 15th deadline. Numbers to call with your questions, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Have you noticed any changes in the number of audits, the type of audits that the IRS has been conducting recently? Has there been any change in volume at all?
Well, the IRS has fairly strict budget constraints, and we're not seeing a lot of activity in individual audits. Steve, would your past experience, would you agree with
that? I agree completely.
Too?
There's always rumors that they are staffing up and they attempt to do more, but they're so their time is so consumed with certain other very specific areas, tax shelters and the like, that it has not increased significantly, no. Yeah.
I would say in the last year, I can only think of maybe one or two individual audits that I'm aware of in our office. We just don't see many.
Let's go to the phones again. Line one in Homer. Good afternoon.
Yes, I got a question regarding, I guess it was you were talking about the percentage charge for not filing or late filing.
Mm-hmm.
And the curious question that I've wondered about was, what happened if you actually had money due?
Okay. Any penalties or interest are based now, are you talking about if you had money due to you, a refund?
Right, a refund.
Okay.
But you didn't file. That was something I had filed an extension, so I didn't have to worry about it. But
sure. Any penalties and interest are only based upon tax which is payable to the Internal Revenue Service. If they have a refund due to you, assuming that they don't subsequently change that to a balance due for some reason, assuming they actually do owe you money, there would not be any penalty or interest. The caution that I would have is that there is a 3-year statute of limitations.
Right.
Meaning that if you are so delinquent that you let several years pass before you get around to filing a return, if that 3-year window of opportunity closes, they keep your refund.
Right. Would be aware of that, and that was something that's how I thought I understood it, but when it comes to the IRS, you know, you don't want to think you understand it, and as I said, I didn't let that go, but...
I would say the majority of our extension clients are people who are confident that they have a refund coming, and they just haven't gotten around to getting the information pulled together. So most of our extension clients don't have to send any money with the return, or at least a significant percentage.
Right.
And it's just the taxpayer doesn't even have to sign the form. We can sign it on your behalf. Away it goes, and you'll get an extra 4 months.
And you're going to want to file the extension in most cases. There are certain elections that you'll want to make sometimes on a return, and they're not valid unless you have an extension in. So even if you think you have a refund coming, we would strongly recommend that you file the extension.
Right. No, I had done that. It was I'd purchased the house, and I had everything still packed up, so I couldn't figure out the basis of what I sold to buy the house.
Sure.
For the taxes. So tax season came, I filed the extension, but then I sat there, and I calculated I was due a pretty significant refund.
Sure.
Yeah. In spite of that basis issue. But then I was thinking, so wait a minute. Now, if I hadn't done that, what kind of penalties? And I didn't think of that now, but it was when you were talking about it before. Like, well, would they subtract a non-filing fee off your refund?
No, not
at all.
Okay, well, thank you for answering my question.
You're welcome.
Thanks
Bye.
For your call. Let's go to line two in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Your question.
I had a question about the earned income credit worksheet on the Illinois 1040 form.
The Illinois 1040 or the federal 1040?
Illinois 1040.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so... says if you qualified for a federal earned income, you may also qualify for the Illinois earned income.
Okay.
And you write in your federal amount, then you get 5% of that. And then it asks, it says, Illinois residents write 1.0. And then on the next step, it says multiply the amount you got for your Illinois by the decimal on line 3, the decimal meaning the number to the right of the decimal point, which would be 0.
No. It's because they know you're a resident, they mean 1 or 100%.
Oh, 1. Okay.
It's placed as a decimal. 1.0 in decimal is 100%, and therefore you would just put the same number down.
Gotcha. Yeah.
The purpose of that is if you're a part-year Illinois resident, they're not going to give you the full credit. They would make you prorate that based upon a period of residency.
I see. Okay, well, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And thank you. Let's go now to Southern Illinois for our next question on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi. I don't know if you've covered this, but what do you do if you've been hit real hard and you have to pay? Is there any way of paying in payments?
Yes. There is an installment payment agreement, the form number of which escapes me. Steve, do you recall the form number for that?
No, I don't.
Okay. There is an installment payment agreement form that you can submit with your 1040. It basically, there is a fee, a user fee for submitting that form. As I recall, it's $25 or $35.
Yeah, I think
like
it had gone up to $43.
Okay, $43 that you have to pay. And you essentially tell the IRS how much you can afford to pay on a monthly basis, and they will get back to you and tell you whether or not they accept your offer for installment payments. It is important to understand that once you have an installment payment agreement in place, you still will be charged interest on the taxes that you owe, and if for any reason you become delinquent on any tax due in a subsequent year, that installment payment is all due and payable at that point. So let's say that you've reached an agreement to pay the IRS back over a 3-year period, and next year you owe them money and you can't pay, so you become delinquent on that. It will accelerate the balance due on that installment payment agreement.
I'm just thinking like about 3 months, and do you know what the interest would be on that? Is that still 0.5%?
No. The 0.5% that we're talking about is a penalty. On top of that, the IRS charges interest. And as I recall, the interest rate runs around 6% on deficiency, Steve?
Yeah, 6 or 7%. And the 0.5% we were talking about before, that's 0.5% a month.
Well, right. I think I'll pay it right away then.
Yeah, I would suggest that you do.
Well, yes. And if your installment agreement or you're offering to pay within the calendar year, that's usually accepted. And they'll come back to you with a letter in about 45 days saying whether or not they accepted the agreement. But if you're offering to pay within 6-7 months and the amount isn't huge, they tend to accept it. Yeah.
But if it's how much?
Under 1,000.
I would suggest that you just pay it. By the time you factor in the IRS interest rate plus the user fee for asking for the installment payment, it ends up being a fairly high rate of interest, and it really, I'm sure you'd be better off just paying it off if you can.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot, and I would assume that you need to get with the IRS fairly well before April 15th on something like that. If you're headed right up to the deadline, is it too late at that point to arrange?
No,
payments?
Actually, you merely attach this form to the top of your 1040 when you submit it, and the presumption is that you will have your installment payment request approved. And if they disapprove it, they will send you a letter back saying, no, we think you need to pay X amount per month rather than what you've proposed. But there is a presumption of acceptance, and you just submit that form with your 1040 right up till the last day.
But as long as it's postmarked April 15th.
So there's no penalty for not having paid by that time if you have something saying or the form saying, let me pay this way.
That's correct, and you've hit the nail on the head. If you don't file that, if you simply don't file your return and file it late and you owe money, or if you file the form and simply don't send the money and you don't ask for the installment agreement, they very likely will hit you with penalties.
You've got to expressly ask for it.
That's right.
All right. Once again, our lines are empty, 333-9455 with your calls on tax questions, 800-222-9455 if you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area. Marty and Steve from RSM McGladrey here to answer your calls. One thing that I bet a lot of people are working on, if not with this year's taxes and probably for next year, is refinancing houses. Mm-hmm. This is a time where a lot of people are buying houses, but a lot of people are also refinancing. What kinds of things do you need to keep track of between now and when you file the taxes, either this year's or next year's?
Well, refinancings are actually almost a non-event from a tax standpoint. You are not permitted to deduct any of the costs associated with refinancing. Mm-hmm. If you pay points, which are fees that you might pay a bank to buy down your interest rate, if it's on an initial purchase of a house, you are permitted to deduct those points as additional interest expense. But on a refinancing, you are not. Instead, you have to amortize or write off those points over the life of the loan.
Let's go to the calls again. Line 4 in Homewood, Illinois. Good afternoon. Oh, let's go to line 4. We're about ready to go. It's gotten all of a sudden busy, so you're lucky to have been the first in this little flood of calls here.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Just a curious question. What does the IRS do with an individual that never files, even though he has W-2 income deducted?
And the W-2, what do you mean W-income deducted?
Well, I mean his salaried or wages, and the employer deducts and sends in to the IRS.
A copy of the W-2?
And the amount and all of that. You know, with the withholding.
So it's been reported to the IRS, but the payer, the taxpayer, hasn't filled any forms.
Correct, yeah.
Well, ultimately, you're going to get a notice from the IRS or this taxpayer. I shouldn't insinuate that you might be this person. This taxpayer who doesn't file will get a notice. The IRS has a matching program where they match things like 1099s, W-2s, and so on against their record of returns having been filed. And if they have received a W-2 showing wages and you don't have a tax return on file, they will send you a letter. But it takes a couple of – they're about 2 years out right now, I think, is what I'm seeing,
yes,
Steve.
Yes, it's not uncommon. It's not uncommon to receive a W-2 for 2 and 3 years in a row and receive no contact from the IRS.
Yeah.
And then if the payer doesn't respond after that?
Well, they'll keep hunting for you.
Yeah, they'll keep hunting. First they'll send a letter that asks you to confirm your address.
Mm-hmm.
And then – or a notice or a letter simply asking where the return is.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll keep hunting for you. If eventually they track this person down, then they will attempt to figure out what the taxes are. If you do not file a return, they will use the information that they have to estimate a tax liability and send you a bill.
And if you don't pay the bill, ultimately they will place a lien on property that you might own, including bank accounts.
Hello. We've lost him. But
maybe he didn't like that answer.
Could be. But that also means the penalties have added up in
Absolutely.
The meantime. So if it's been 2 years and they haven't gotten a hold of you, they'll charge you for those 2 years of back
penalty and interest from the date of original file.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big check.
It is.
All right. Line 2 in Champaign. Good afternoon. Hello, line 2.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, the question I have is this. It concerns dividend reinvestment programs.
Okay.
And over 20 years ago, I bought a bunch of stock, and I've accumulated some over the years, but sometimes it was only a fractional share, sometimes I would kick some money in, and now I want to sell some of it, but I don't really have a clue as to how much I paid for it.
Well, that is a common problem. Dividend reinvestment programs, or DRIP programs, are something that are commonly used, and they are the bane of our existence from the standpoint of calculating gain.
Right.
The company that whose stock you own won't have those records. The burden is on you as the taxpayer, and what you will need to do is hopefully you receive a year-end statement that shows all of your investment activity with that particular stock.
Right.
And hopefully you have kept those records.
Well, what do you do if you haven't?
Well, then you contact Shareholder Services Department at the corporation that you own the stock in, and generally they can provide a history of those shares that you have purchased.
Okay.
But what you need to do is to go back and track not only the purchases that you have made through actual cash investments, but also all of the little dividend, you know, the fractional shares
right,
that you have
right.
purchased with each dividend payment.
Yeah.
And it can be, depending upon how far back this goes, it can be a very significant task.
It's a nightmare.
Yes. Yeah, that would be how we would describe it too.
So just call the Shareholder Services and see if they can give me something.
Yeah.
See if they can get you something, and you'd be surprised. Sometimes it's really quite worth the effort.
Yes, it can really add up over the years. Now, another thing that you can do, if you can't get that information, but if you have copies of the tax returns, each year as those dividends have been paid, you've been reporting that dividend income.
Right. So
if you know that you have, without fail, reinvested every dollar of dividend income into that stock, as a way of reconstructing this, you could go back and look at every tax return that you have filed since you first bought that stock.
Of course, I don't even have that. I mean, this is going back like 24 years.
Okay. Well, what I was going to suggest is that you could go to the Schedule B, which is the schedule showing dividend income, and merely add up all of the dividend income, knowing that at least you have that much additional basis in that stock. But if you don't have copies of the tax returns, you're really...
That avenue
limits you. Yeah, it does. Now, you can obtain copies of returns from the IRS, but not 20 years ago.
Right.
I mean, ultimately, I've had clients who have been in... who have had this situation, and what they decided to do was to not sell that stock, sell something else, and die holding that stock, because then you get a step up in basis to fair market value and nobody cares.
All right.
Well, thanks for your call.
Okay, well, thanks, guys.
Appreciate it. Let's go on to line three in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello. I have a question about dividing up expenses, employee business expenses and consulting expenses. I've got 1099 miscellaneous forms and international income, which is essentially consulting. And then I've got unreimbursed employee business expenses, which is travel, international travel. And so I'm wondering, can I divide those up into Schedule C and Schedule whatever it is, unreimbursed employee business expenses? And then how do I take the travel expenses? Can I use a per diem, or do I have to use the real expenses?
Okay. There are you've got a couple of different questions. First of all, how do you divide them up? You really need to look at the nature of the expense to determine whether you incurred it in connection with your job as an employee versus your work as a consultant. And with, for example, with the university, this is a fairly common problem. So you need to take a look at the expenses and try to attribute the expense accurately to the income that was generated as a result of those expenses.
Yes, exactly right. Whether you're going to a per diem or you're taking actual expenses, that particular travel or that particular meal or that particular out-of-pocket expense was caused either by your acting as a consultant or an employee, and you have to decide each time which it was and divide those expenses as they occur.
Okay.
And with respect to the per diems, there are different per diem tables. There's something called a CONUS or Continental United States table that you would use, and in that they merely break it down into a high cost and a low cost table. When you get outside the United States, there's something called the OCONUS, Outside Continental United States table, and that is actually broken down by specific country and city and even time of the year depending upon a particular location, and you are permitted to use those per diem tables in lieu of actual expenses, and in some cases, depending upon if you're being frugal, those per diem tables may benefit you. It certainly makes your record keeping a lot easier.
But nonetheless, you have to decide for that expense whether
right.
you did it as a consultant or employee.
Right.
Is there a difference between employee and consulting in terms of whether you can use the per diem lodging and meals?
No, you can use the per diem for either type of expense. An expense which is attributable to your consulting income will be much more beneficial to you in most cases because you are allowed to deduct that directly from the consulting income. And not only are you saving income tax, federal income tax, you also save state income tax and self-employment tax. Your employee business expenses would go in a Form 2106 and ultimately carry over to Schedule A in the miscellaneous itemized deduction area. That category of deductions is subject to a limitation. It has to exceed 2% of your income before you get any benefit. And many people don't obtain a benefit for that type of tax deduction.
And no state benefit and no reduction of your self-employment tax, your FICA.
And ultimately, you could even have alternative minimum tax triggered by it.
So it does you no good at all.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Consulting expense is obviously more beneficial.
Yeah.
But
to the extent that you can kind of lean on it a little bit, if you've got expenses which are in a gray area, they will be more beneficial to you on the Schedule C as a consulting expense.
Great. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call. We've got room for maybe one more call for somebody who calls right away at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 for Marty Verdick and Steve Winterstein. Tax questions this afternoon. If there's – list if you could maybe the two or three deductions that most people overlook and don't take, and they probably could be eligible for them, things that you may not know about?
Well, the I'll throw out a couple of things. Itemized deductions for individuals really are broken down into three. While there are five or six categories listed on Schedule I, from a practical standpoint, there are only three. Mm-hmm. There would be the taxes, which would be state income tax and real estate taxes. There's going to be interest expense on a mortgage, not personal or consumer interest. And there's going to be charitable contributions. The charitable contributions one is one that I think, I mean, most people periodically clean out the closet and take a load down to Salvation Army or Goodwill. And many people don't even think about claiming that as a deduction. The others are very simple to figure out. You get a 1098 for your mortgage interest. You get a real estate tax bill. People aren't going to miss those for the most part. Steve, assuming we're not talking about business kinds of things,
right,
just individuals.
Right.
They tend to miss that, and occasionally they don't keep track of their mileage, and so certain employee expense, unreimbursed expenses, they simply don't keep track.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Line 4 in Oakwood, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I've got a question similar to the earlier caller's regarding the basis. He was wondering about his stock basis, but I have a little different problem. I've got a situation where I have done 1031 exchanges for about 20, 25 years.
Okay.
I have a lot of them. 20 or 30, and I'm not sure I could figure it out,
well,
even if I could track them all.
Okay. Each of those exchanges should have been reported on a form 8824, which is the like-kind exchange form, and if that form is done properly and you have it, it will tell you what your tax basis is in your replacement property on each like-kind exchange.
Okay, That form was not around 10 or 15 years ago.
Okay. I realize that form is relatively new, I mean,
now,
within the last decade. The burden, unfortunately, is on you, the taxpayer, to be able to reconstruct that.
I understand that. Let me add one more point to this.
Mm-hmm.
If one of those trades would get thrown out, say, in 1985, the way I understand it, I would owe interest and penalty from then to date, correct?
Well, the statute of limitations for that year would have run. And when you say thrown out, you mean if it was determined that it was not a valid like-kind exchange?
Yes.
What would happen is that they can't go back and collect taxes from 15 years ago.
Not if you file a return.
Not if you file. Assuming you filed a tax return, you've got a three-year statute of limitations. So they couldn't go back 15 years ago and get that tax.
I see. So you have a three-year statute of limitations even on a trade?
Well, there's 3 and 6 years. Generally 3 years. Six years if your taxes are substantially understated. But
I see.
But generally 3 years. 3 years, 6 years.
For the most part.
But 15 years, no. Not if you filed your return back then.
All right.
I see. Okay. Well, what I was going to do is I was just going to put no basis. And since we're in a 15% bracket now.
Well, you're certainly safe by doing that, but you're probably overpaying on tax a little bit.
Oh, I understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're certainly safe doing it.
Yeah. Right.
Yep.
Well, that's another alternative.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And let's go to a cell phone, our final call, if we can make it kind of short, on line 1. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Yes.
I got an IRA last fall, and I also bought a Roth IRA.
If you'd want to turn your volume down real quick.
On your radio?
On your radio? Yeah, there you go.
Yes, better.
Okay. I got an IRA last fall about 6 months ago, and then I bought a Roth IRA in December or January, I can't remember. But evidently I'm supposed to receive some type of form that helps me calculate my taxes with that.
Well, every time someone makes an IRA contribution, as I recall, the form number is a 5498, I think it is, that the bank or other investment institution would send to you showing the amount that you contributed to your IRA. But you don't need that form to complete your taxes. If you know how much you put in, that's not a form that you have to send in with the tax return.
All right. Was it called 5498?
Yes.
Okay. I'll contact my person that I did the investment with, I guess, too, to see.
Yeah, but it's not a form that you've got to have to complete your return. If you don't get it, you know how much you put in, and you can go from there.
You just total up and that's it?
Yep.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay.
And thank you for your call, and thanks for all of our callers this afternoon for having us answer some of your tax questions. Hopefully the answers will all help you out. Marty Verdict and Steve Winterstein, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
It's always
fun.
We'll
see you next year, perhaps.
Thank you.
Happy to do it. Maybe an off-season tax show. But I'm sure you guys will be happy after April 15th.
Oh, yes.
Marty Verdict and Steve Winterstein are both from RSM McGladrey's Champaign Tax Department. And thanks to both of them for being here this afternoon. Let's go now to the settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade. With those numbers, here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. And looking at the Chicago Board of Trade, fairly quiet day today at the Chicago Board of Trade. Ahead of Wednesday's USDA grain stocks and prospective plantings report, a lot of position squaring still going on, most of that happening in the bean pit. And in fact, in the bean pit today, the nearby contracts were up just a little, but the defer up to unchanged. But the deferreds that August on out were down anywhere between 4 and 5 cents. We'll take a look, complete look at those numbers in just a moment. Let's begin in the wheat pit like we do every afternoon for this Monday. May futures in the wheat, a high today of 407, a low at 398, a settlement price there at 405 and three quarters. They finished the day a half cent higher. July futures in the wheat pit, 411, the high, the low at 402 and a half, a settlement, 410 and a quarter. They were up a half as well. September futures for the wheat, 414 and a half, the high, the low at 406 and a half, a settlement price at 414, up one and a quarter. In December contract, 422, the high, the low at 413, a settlement price at 421 and three quarters, up 1 1/4 for the day. The March futures, 423.5, the high, the low at 415.5, a settlement price at 423.5, up 2.5 cents. By the way, at 6 after the hour, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing today. We'll ask him the same questions that we put to the folks that were on Commodity Week over the weekend. If you didn't hear that program, by the way, it's probably worthwhile going back and listening to on the website at WILL.UIUC.edu. We'll ask Kurt whether there's anything producers should be doing before this Wednesday report. Most people think it will be pivotal for the contracts in both the corn and the bean pits. Now, the corn futures, May contract, 306.5, the high, the low at 301 and three quarters. The settlement price there at 305, they were down a half. July, 310 and a quarter, the high, the low at 306. The settlement price at 309 and three quarters, and they finished unchanged. September futures, a 306 and a quarter high, low at 301 and three quarters. The settlement price for the SEPs, 305 and a quarter, down a quarter. And the December contract, that's your harvest month, down a penny for the day. 301 and a quarter on the high, the low at 297 and a quarter, settled up above that $3 area at $3.75. Once again, the December contract down 1 cent for the day. March futures, 304 and a quarter high, low at 299 and three quarters, a settlement to 303 and three quarters, down a quarter. And the May futures, 306 the high, the low at 302, settlement to 305 and a half, down a half. July corn for next year, that's the 05 contract, 306 the high, the low at 302 and a half, a settlement price at 305 and a half, and they finished a half lower. And December 2 years out, through 267, the high, the low at 266. The December 2005 corn contract settled the day unchanged at 266.5. May oats now 169.5, the high, the low at 164. And the settlement price at 168 and three quarters, up 3. And July futures, 173.5, the high, the low at 168.5, and a settlement price at 173. They were up 3.25 on the day. From the soy complex, the nearby May beans at 10.17 on the high, the low at 10.01, a settlement price at $10.13 even, unchanged on the day. July beans, 10.07, the high, the low at 9.92, settled $10.03 and three quarters, up three quarters. August soybeans, 9.69, the high, the low at 9.56, the settlement price at 9.63.5. They were down 4. September's 8.60, the high, the low at 8.47, a settlement price at 8.53.5, down a nickel even. November soybeans, 7.67, the high, the low at 7.55, a settlement price there at 7.63.75. They finished 3.75 lower. January 7.64, the high, the low at 7.56, and a settlement at 7.61, down 5. And the March 05 contract for the beans, 7.57, the high, the low at 7.46, the settlement price at 7.54. They finished down 4 for the day. The May bean meal, 3.18.30 for the high, the low at 3.11.80, a settlement price at 3.14.50, down 2.40. And July meal, 3.15.50, the high, the low at 3.08.30, settlement price at 3.10.90, down 2.20. May bean oil, 33.50, the high, the low at 32.81, and settlement price at 33.39. They were up 2 for the day. In July bean oil, 33.30, the high, the low at 32.61, a settlement price there at 33.27. they finished 4 higher. Now here's Tom Rogers with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Tom?
Thanks a lot, Todd, and let's take a look at those closes, all finishing up except for the pork bellies today. March feeder cattle had a high today of 90.70, the low 90.62.5, settled at the low 90.62.5, up 15. April had a high of 89.20, the low 88.30, settled at 89 even, up 30. The May feeder cattle had a high of 87.50, the low 86.25, settled at 87.12.5, up 50. And August had a high of 88.17.5, the low 87.35, settled under the close, under the high rather, at 88.10. That was up 35 points on the day. April live cattle had a high of 78.20, the low 77.25, settled at 77.77.5, up 57.5. June had a high of 74.75, the low 73.35, settled at 74.30, up 67.5. August live cattle had a high of 74.60, the low 73.80, settled at 74.32.5. That was up 550 on the day, or 55 on the day, rather. And the October live cattle had a high of 76.75, the low 75.95, settled at 76.47.5, up 32.5. Bigger gains in hogs today. The April lean hog contract had a high of 68.15, the low 66.40, settled at 68.12.5. That was up 172.5 on the day. May lean hogs, the high 68.70, the low 66.75, settled at 68.70, up 150. June lean hogs, 73.77.5 was the high and the close. The low was 71.30, and the settlement was up 200 over yesterday. July lean hogs had a high of 70.25, the low 67.75, settled at 70.15, up 182.5. The down note, though, in pork bellies today, March bellies had a high of 11.300, the low 10.900, settled at the low 10.900, that's down 100 points on the day. And May bellies had a high of 10.825, the low 10.615, settled at 10.727.5, down 80. Quick check of the Dow right now. It's up about 120 points at 10,033. The NASDAQ up 29 points at 1989. The S&P up 15 at 1122. And those are the numbers from the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2004 lecture series presents The Broken Promise of Brown by Julian Bond, Chairman, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, on Friday, April 2nd at 7:30 p.m. in the auditorium of Smith Memorial Hall, 805 South Matthews Avenue, Urbana, on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Brad Schnoor from Deerfield, Illinois writes, Dear Dr. Science, do you own a pet? What kind of pet is it? Is it well trained?
I have Rodney, my research assistant. Most of the time he does what he's told, and when he does it, well, the shock collar corrects his random deviation. As for non-human pets, well, most of them have been reptiles or amphibians. They make Rodney seem positively warm-blooded in comparison. When I was a boy, my parents took me to a Mexican beach on vacation. It was there that I stumbled across a giant sea turtle laying her eggs. Fortunately, she fit neatly in the trunk of our